Welcome to the Phil Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:20 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 7th, today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And certainly we have a lot to talk about this week. I thought the most important thing that we've seen is the large upside weekly key reversals that we saw on the S&P and the NASDAQ 100. And this is about as emphatic a move that one could wish for in order to dispel the concerns that have been arising over the last few weeks about potential top formation development. This is a resounding knockback on the bearish argument. It is certainly indicative of short covering, and this is a resounding bounce from the region of the trend mean. And the fact that it is visible on a 10-year chart, looking all the way back to the lows in 2009, tells us that this is a significant move. There is still a sequence of higher reaction lows, higher highs, in this range, and this has been a pretty modest pullback. It was, I think, somewhat predictable that we were going to have a slightly larger pullback following what was a very impressive rebound off the lows in December. Now the, I think, more important point is to look at this chart on a log scale. Because when we think about it on a log scale and take away the considerations about the outlook from a leveraged perspective and think more in terms of the unleveraged investor, this range that we've seen over the course of the last 18 months is quite similar to the range that persisted between 2014 and 2015. And we have had now a very impressive rebound. We've had a consolidation. We've had a bounce from the region of the trend mean. This greatly increases the potential that we're going to see this market resolve this range on the upside, and we're going to get another leg on the upside from this bull market. Now, the big question for a lot of people is whether this is just another step in an overall secular bull market that has got years left to run. Is it going to be the final leg higher in terms of this decade-long bull market and create bubbly activity? So that's the big question, I think, for a lot of investors, is where are we in the cycle? Are we at the end of a secular bull market or in the middle of one? Well, I think we're probably somewhere in between, that there is a long-term secular bull market that could potentially run until the early 2030s. But we're probably late in the medium term cycle. But the big question then is, what's the story with monetary policy? And that's the most important factor, because when we start to think about the outlook for markets, you can't have a bull market without lots of liquidity. And there is no shortage of liquidity out there, particularly in view of the statements made by the Federal Reserve this week. In fact, if you think about last year, what people were most concerned about, it's not so much about the trade war, it was about whether the Federal Reserve was willing to step in and support markets. It took a 20% drawdown in the fourth quarter of last year to confirm that question, but we know what the answer is. There's now a Powell put. The big move that we've had this week was in response to what the Federal Reserve had to say about their willingness to step in and support the market in the event that it was required. Now, that is important because prior to this, the rhetoric coming from the central bank had been simple enough that they were 50-50 on whether they wanted to raise rates or cut rates. Well, the raising rates option has now been taken off the table, and that is, I think, a big part of the reason why we've seen this rebound in here this week, because the bond market is now in the process of pricing in a rate cut imminently. If we look at 12-month yields, The yield at the moment was down another 6 basis points today. It's below 2%. At the end of last year, it was pricing in one more rate cut within the next 12 months. Now it's pricing in not just one, but two rate cuts within the next 12 months. And one of those rate cuts was priced in this week. It was at 2.25% at the end of last week, and it's below 2% in here today. Now, this has been an extremely abrupt move. There is no doubt in, I think if we simply look at the chart, there is nobody could deny that this chart is accelerating. The pace of the decline was relatively moderate until last week. It massively accelerated this week. We've also had a meaningful move in the 10-year Treasury price, and it is certainly picking up pace in here. Now, it has paused around this 127.5 area. That's quite predictable. It paused at 122.5. It paused at 125. Now it's pausing at 127.5. Each of those previous consolidations was about a 2.5-point pullback, and it found support in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. Well, that suggests that 125 is the next area of important support. We may not see it come back to that. There is a rapid pricing in of rate cuts going on right now. Now, this is also one of the most important points, and it's that, generally speaking, it's when you have an inverted yield curve, it's when the yield curve starts to expand again, that you have to get really cautionary, because they wouldn't cut rates unless they were really worried about the economy. Then we also have to consider they wouldn't cut rates unless there really was a big problem. And generally, it's not so much when the Federal Reserve goes on pause, but rather when they actually cut rates that you start to see selling pressure coming through. So that has to at least give people some pause. But I think there is an answer that we can perhaps thread our way through this conundrum. I was at a Marcus Evans conference this week, and there were a lot of people there talking about the markets, pitching their various ideas for investments. It gave me a bird's eye perspective on the eagerness that investors now have for investing in private equities. I'll talk more about that in a moment. But there was a talk by a former head of asset management or global strategy at Deutsche Asset Management that I paid particular attention to, because he was talking about the kinds of signals that we do get from the yield curve. He certainly wasn't denying that it's still a predictive tool. What he was highlighting, though, is that, and this is also something that Leon Tuohy, who is somebody that Jeff Sought tends to quote rather often, that the more predictive tool is the difference between the 30-year and the 3-month. But regardless of whether one looks at the 30 to 3-month or the 10 and 2 spread, neither of those are inverted. So I think that is rather important. I think it's also important to look at more back history, because I think if we had to think about any analog, then perhaps we're more in a situation like 1994, or potentially more like 1998, but again, the yield curve has not inverted. So that's, I think, an important consideration. That suggests that we are not at the end of the cycle just yet. Now, what we have certainly seen has been an inversion at part of the cycle, where what we've certainly had was an inversion in part of the curve. So that was certainly evident, and it's still evident, in the shorter part of the curve. Then Morgan Stanley has also been adjusting the yield curve based upon its prognostication that it should be adjusted based on quantitative easing and subsequently quantitative tightening. I do have some sympathy with that argument, but It's one thing to have an argument, it's quite another to see evidence of rolling over in the stock markets. But the other point that McCall Lamb was making, I thought was a very good point with regard to the fact that when you do get these signals from the yield curve, what you also tend to get is corroboration in other yield curve spreads. And that's most particularly true of the muni spread and the investment grade spread. Well, the muni spread is currently around 26 basis points, but it is not inverted. And the investment grade spread is looking very similar to the yield curve spread, and it is trading at a rather substantial premium, so it's certainly not inverted. Now, if we don't have a classic inverted yield curve or a muni curve or an investment grade curve, and we're seeing clear evidence of stock markets bouncing from the region of their respective trend means, then what that suggests is we should really be giving the weight of evidence to the classic interpretation of the yield curve. And I think that's the big lesson here, that we just have to pay attention to what people are doing with their money. And this move we've had in the NASDAQ 100 in here this week is really quite impressive. That it had got down below the 7,000 level, it had traded briefly below the trend mean, and then had a rollicking advance over the course of the last few days, and is pushed right back above it. This is by far the most important characteristic that we have. Now, when we look at, for example, the sectors that have been leading on the upside, well, cloud computing is very much in that category, and the fact is that it had broken upwards to new highs and now is subsequently finding support in the region of the previous peak from back in 2018. So that's a really impressive performance here. And it's not quite at an upside Q reversal today, but certainly there is scope for additional upside having now unwound that overbought condition relative to the trend mean. So this is, I think, we're potentially primed now for a resumption of the medium-term bull market. Now, there are a couple of other points that I think are really very relevant. The first is, at this conference, there were a number of private equity firms, some looking to invest in very early stage companies, others looking at the mezzanine rounds of funding, particularly in the clean technology sector. It's no longer the clean energy sector. People have pretty much given up on trying to compete with oil when natural gas prices are this low. So now they're looking more at clean technology and efficiency gains. But that was another topic that I found interesting. But one of the most important points was that not only were there a significant number of private equity companies, but what I also saw was that there were a number of investors rather keen to hear what they had to say. I was talking with one person in particular that really I found it to be an incredibly illuminating conversation. He'd been a long short equity portfolio manager at PIMCO for 7 years. There's one of the company's billionaire clients had invited him and another chap to start a fund that would be on the side continuing a long short equity strategy, but that more than 50% of the assets were to be destined for private deals because they were being attracted by the really impressive returns that are available in these private deals. But what I found interesting then today was looking at the number of new funds, and the number of funds that have been formed has that in fact been trending downwards over the course of the last few years. The returns available on these, particularly in the secondary round of funding, has been increasing, particularly from 2012 to 2016. The big question is now, what are the returns like at present? The very fact that we've had the fact that this chart peaked in 2016 would suggest that the amount of money being made from these kinds of deals has been decreasing. Then, when we think about the performance, for example, of some of the big listed private equity companies, well, they do throw off impressive yields. And that is certainly one of the reasons why people have liked them historically. But we also know that since 2016, these yields have been contracting. What this, if we think then about the performance of these private equity companies, it suggests that some of their best years are potentially behind them, and yet the quantity of money chasing deals continues to increase. Then, when we look at, for example, I did find a private equity ETF this morning that I was looking at, and when we start to think about how these private equity companies have performed on aggregate, well, private equity, if we think then that it's usually in the first round and the second round of funding that the most money is made, it's by the time that these companies come up to be listed, they're usually saddled with a great deal of debt, and the majority of the money has already been made. Then when the private equity company itself goes for an exit, then there is almost certainly all of the money has been made, and it is really down to the attractiveness of the portfolio assets that are coming to market that really will dictate the profitability subsequently. But the ETF has been ranging for a decade and it has basically gone nowhere. This is a very significant period of underperformance for the private equity sector, and they have stopped paying dividends. Well, what this tells me is that the private equity sector is not in such great shape, and yet there is billions looking to invest once more. Well, that tells us that the prices being paid for assets is very high, and that anybody with even a modicum of marketing skill can probably raise money from private equity at the moment. We also saw that Neil Woodford in the UK this week has run into trouble because he wasn't able to meet redemptions from his fund because he was investing in these private deals and they are obviously illiquid. Then there was an additional news story today that the Church of England for its pension fund is no longer going to be investing in equities and is looking much more towards private deals. So what this suggests is that there are people being attracted by the very impressive returns that can be made from private equity on paper, but that they're probably coming in too late in the cycle. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that there are no good deals out there, but it does suggest that one should be approaching this sector with a modicum of, caution. Of course, there is always going to be the exception that proves the rule. And Beyond Meats was up approximately 40% over the course of the last 24 hours on an impressive earnings estimate. This has been one of the most successful IPOs in years. It is trading on an extraordinary valuation, and obviously it is nowhere near making positive earnings in here to generate a PE ratio, but it's currently trading at a valuation of about $8 billion. It has the benefit, of course, of being in a highly fashionable area. Being a vegan in Los Angeles these days is almost a badge of honor, and that is something that is likely to become a much more widespread condition, particularly because a number of the fast food restaurants are taking on meat alternative products because it attracts a new breed of customer that wouldn't normally be caught dead in a fast food restaurant. So it is an additional income stream for these fast food establishments, and that is certainly something that will make them of interest. Well, one thing we certainly know is that the quantity of money that private equity funds have as dry powder has been expanding rapidly. It was at about 1.7 trillion in the last couple of years. It's now upwards of 3 trillion. And that's a rather extraordinary amount of money. It was 2 trillion last year. I've seen graphs saying that it's approximately 3 trillion this year. That's incredible sources of additional liquidity that can pour into this market, regardless of the fact that it is likely that returns are starting to decrease. But this is also representative of this drive towards trying to capture yield. And they're trying to capture yield because of extraordinarily low interest rates. Then, if we think about one of the most glaring examples of that desire to capture yield is in Italian government bond debt, and that has now clearly encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. It has been compressing for just about all of this year, and from the end of last year. The 10-year yield in Italy is down to 2.35%. And with the compression that we're seeing in yields globally, the fact that that German Bund yields are at negative 25 basis points and still trending down at new all-time lows. Well, if zero is not a terminal value, then you can simply continue to add integers. There is no terminal level once you move below zero. So I think this is a very meaningful environment that we have right now. When we think about what exactly is going on, we have huge amounts of money that are sitting on the sidelines waiting for a signal. There is massive quantities of money sitting in private equity dry powder. Well, rationally, what if I was managing a private equity fund, I would be rather cautious right now because returns do appear to be compressing. I'd be looking for bargains, the kinds of bargains that Heinz and GE represent, where intangible assets will be excised from the valuation, and then you also get some forced selling, which creates bargain type scenarios. Excuse me. That's, I think, a useful potential avenue for private equity dry powder. But that needn't necessarily be where that money is going to be committed, because you can't simply have money sitting on the sidelines in an environment where asset prices are starting to rise once more. Then, of course, you have companies that are sitting on record piles of cash, and that's why the share buybacks are going to be higher this year than last year, and last year was a record. Of course, the point is well made that the quantity of money required to have the same influence on the market as has been done previously needs to increase at almost an exponential rate. And that is it, certainly we're getting higher values, but that quantity increase, that percentage increase, year on year is not increasing, but it does represent a very significant source of additional demand for the market. The PKW Buyback Achievers Index looks almost identical to the S&P 500, except for the fact that the peak put in this year is higher than the last peak last year. And other than that, it's looking pretty similar. Well, we then know that some of this cash on the sidelines is going to be put to use in the stock market. And this is the kind of scenario where you can potentially get bubble risk. So there are going to be assets that become way overvalued, but it's quite potentially going to be in the private sector rather than the public sector that this occurs. Because the valuations that are being attached to the big private companies, and indeed early stage private companies, is completely out of character with their earnings potential. So I think that's one of the clear differences in this cycle, where we have had such an incredible volume of money created that it has allowed a significantly larger number of potential ideas reach the funding stage than would have been possible otherwise. And therefore, it is potentially now in the unlisted sector where we have the biggest problems. And they're totally masked because it's not until we have a real credit crunch that those types of potential problems are going to be explored. We have had a, I think, a taste of what a future problem might look like with Neil Woodford's funds in here this week, because we simply don't know how many other funds have been investing in private deals in an effort to try and improve performance against a background where the search for yield has compressed yields very considerably. One of the shares that I think is of particular interest is Visa, because Visa has got an incredible record of increasing dividends, and yet the yield is currently sitting at about 0.6%, but the dividend growth rate is in the order of 20 something percent. So that represents a, I think, a very key arbiter of the appetite for consumer demand and for the rise of the digital economy. And the share is definitely starting to pick up pace. Even when we look at this on a weekly basis, we can conclude, or excuse me, on a logarithmic scale basis, we can conclude that the pace of the advance is starting to pick up. And that also tells us that there is a lot of liquidity sloshing around looking for a yield. That's also part of the reason why we continue to see the utility sector exhibiting relative strength, because of the reliability of its cash flows. The consumer staples sector also falls into that category, and it is on the cusp now of breaking out to new highs and completing what is effectively a 3-year range, following what had previously been a really rather impressive and very consistent medium-term advance. And I think that is one of the most important characteristics. It was the efforts by the Federal Reserve to try and normalize policy over the course of the last 2 years that resulted in competition in yield for some of these bond proxy type companies. And now the clear change that we've had, particularly this week, is that the Federal Reserve is no longer competing in terms of the bond proxy. There has been an enormous argument going on in the financial markets, in the political sphere, in the blogs, about the wisdom or otherwise of modern monetary theory. But the reality is we've already got it. When we look at not what everyone thinks might happen in future, but simply what is going on today, we have a US government which is running the largest deficits outside of wartime in history. We have a central bank that has conceded that they cannot raise interest rates any further and that the next move will be downwards. That is going to reduce the cost of refinancing, and there is an enormous amount of debt that needs to be refinanced over the coming years. It is going to further depress government bond yields. It is literally creating a market for the debt that is going to be issued to fund these deficits. What we are just beginning to see is the natural result of this kind of action, which is to depress the value of the currency. And this is modern monetary theory in action. What modern monetary theory is all about is a compact between the central bank and the government to spend and borrow, and to do so in a very coordinated fashion, paying little attention to the impact that is going to have on the currency, and to ignore the size of deficits as long as you don't have inflation. Well, inflationary pressures are certainly not a problem. What we've seen in here this week was that new hires was at 275,000 last month and 27,000 this month, that PMI figures are coming in at very close to neutral, if not negative, levels in the USA, but they are negative in Japan, South Korea, Germany, the UK, and France, and Italy, and indeed in China. So there is obviously an issue in terms of global activity, and that is not inflationary. Wage growth came in a little weaker than anticipated in here today, so that is also sapping the argument for an inflationary outcome. And as long as they don't have overt inflation that is incontrovertible, then there is no rational argument that the Federal Reserve can use to continue to raise interest rates, not least because of the damage that it would do on a just on a simply national health basis, that if the Federal Reserve were raising interest rates in an aggressive environment when the federal government had a pile of debt to refinance, then that would be tantamount to treason if they didn't have a clear rationale for not aiding in that effort. They would be accused of deliberately trying to reduce US living standards. So there isn't really a lot that the Federal Reserve can do in this kind of environment if they don't have the backup of an inflation figure. But that does suggest that the dollar is going to become, is going to start taking that pressure. When we look at Europe, I think the European governments, particularly those that have got a heavy populist influence, would love to be doing what the federal government in the USA is doing, but they are constrained from action. The rather miserly LTRO program that was LTRO 3 program that was introduced in the last few months is just simply not going to get it done in terms of liquidity provision for Europe. The ECB only ended their quantitative easing program in December, and they are now at a point where they're supporting their currency more than the USA is doing. So that is one of the defining points in terms of the outlook for the euro. It has been up in a dynamic manner in here this week, and in fact this is the most dynamic move we've seen in nearly a year. And it is now right in the region of the trend mean. But more importantly than that, I think, is that it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It hasn't quite yet been able to break the entire downtrend. And the ECB certainly doesn't want to have a strong currency. But right now, I think the USA is doing more to weaken its currency than Europe is. Well, that is likely to represent the end of this, I think, moderation in the dollar's advance, and could quite easily turn into a period when the dollar will start to weaken. This concern about the reality of modern monetary theory, rather than simply thinking about it in terms of a risk, it is a reality. Well, that is obviously something that gold investors are now beginning to pay very clear attention to. The gold price was up in a dynamic manner in here this week. It has clearly confirmed support in the region of the trend mean. It's coming right up to test the upper side of this evolving base formation. I think the best way to think about this is not so much about it needing to get to $1,380 in order to complete the base, because that was the peak that we saw back here in 2016, but rather that every single time it has got up to the $1,350 area, it has failed. So what it needs to do is not only get up to $1,350, but sustain a move above it. And if it can do that, then we're back in a demand-dominated environment. But the likelihood is that the market is pricing in this eventuality. There is, I think, a strong likelihood that this base formation in gold is in its latter stages, and that it is going to be resolved with a break on the upside, not least as a hedge to the reality of modern monetary theory. Now, if we look at gold and how it's performing in other currencies, then we also get some additional information, because gold does best when it is appreciating in all currencies. One of the most important of those is the renminbi, and it broke clearly and strongly above the 9,000 yuan level to the dollar in, or to gold in here this week. This is by far the most emphatic move we've had since 2016. And I do think it is worth just keeping an eye on these longer term charts. Then when we look at the Indian rupee, again, another major consumer of gold, there's been a sequence of higher reaction lows for nearly 3 years, and it is coming back up towards the peaks posted in 2012. Against the pound, the price of gold has been clearing the £1,000 level, and is coming back towards this peak put in 2016. The weakness of the Australian dollar over the course of the last few years has resulted in gold now pushing on to new all-time highs. I thought it was particularly interesting at doing the chart seminar in Sydney back in 2010, and gold and hadn't really been doing anything in Australian dollars. Well, we are in a very different environment now, where the Australian dollar has pulled back significantly, and now gold is leading on the upside in Australian dollars. That's having a material effect on some of Australia's larger gold mines. Newcrest in particular has been ranging for a fairly significant period and now is breaking on the upside. And this is looking like one of the more emphatic breakouts we're seeing in the precious metals sector. But if we simply look at the SPDR gold ETF, gold shares ETF. It's rebounded really very impressively over the course of the last couple of days, and it's back in the region of the upper side of its base formation. It's looking really very similar to the gold price. What that also suggests is that there are a significant number of gold miners have the potential to offer upside leverage. Sibanye-Stillwater is, I think, a rather interesting one because they have been engaged in a great deal of M&A activity, which has resulted in the share collapsing from 12 to 2. But it is now looking like it's on a recovery trajectory. They have had their rather attractive, well, attractive from Sibanye's perspective, bid for Lonmin accepted. So they're now also a major platinum producer. One thing I think is rather interesting in here is if we just simply look at absolute values, because the gold price right now is trading at 1300 and approximately $40. And that is a fraction of where it was back at its peak. But when we think about platinum prices, well, platinum had historically traded at a significant premium to gold, but it is now at $805. So that ratio is rather significant. It gives us a, I think, a rather interesting environment. There is, when we think about the gold-silver ratio, it's coming up to a level that we haven't seen in a long time. And the last time it got above 90, it paused at around 100, and that was all the way back in the early 1990s. I think the most important thing is that this ratio is still consistent. So there is scope for gold to continue to outperform, but gold won't outperform silver indefinitely because people will start looking for a proxy. And silver prices have rallied this week to break their sequence of lower rally highs, closing out around the $15 area in here today. If it can hold this advance, then I think we can start to conclude that we're back in a demand-dominated environment for silver. So I think that's an important thing to bear in mind, that silver and platinum are really quite cheap relative to gold, whereas palladium is right around the price of gold right now, and there is, I think, the scope here for gold to start to outperform once more. Palladium prices have notably been among the clearest beneficiaries of the change in demand for catalytic converters. One thing I think is perhaps not really being priced in at all is just how much natural gas there is out there. And it is not just a byproduct of unconventional drilling, but there is oodles of the stuff around. Well, when you start to get prices coming down significantly from where they traded during the commodity bull market, natural gas is one of the few commodities that has come all the way back down towards the lows put in before the bull market even began. And I think that's a very meaningful change when we think about the fact that prior to the bull market, natural gas prices traded between about $1 and $4, and now look likely to trade between about $2 and $4. Well, when we consider the quantity of gas that's being produced and the relatively low cost of that gas, well, we can anticipate that there are going to be new use cases come up for it. Well, one of those is to displace coal, and most particularly in China. Just planting coal in India is probably going to take some more time, but the potential for gas to just plant coal in China is a rather significant use case and potential source of demand growth over the medium term. Then we have the reformulating of gas to create hydrogen and the evolution of hydrogen fuel cells, particularly as range extenders for haulage vehicles. And that's a very meaningful potential use case as well. It's exactly these kinds of use cases that evolve and eventually overwhelm supply. And that's when you start to get supply inelasticity meets rising demand type bull markets. So we already know how this long base formation is going to end. But we're a long way from that right now. There is a strong likelihood that natural gas will be ranging mostly below $4 for another decade. And the quantity of gas that's being brought to market virtually ensures that. Now, when we look at Brent crude, it has bounced from around the $60 area. Another one of the meetings I had in here this week was with an oil and gas private equity investor who made the estimate that the vast majority of projects in the Permian have a $50 break even. So I thought it was interesting in here today that WTI bounced from the $50 area, or this week I should say. That rather confirms that that is where a lot of the break evens are in terms of US onshore domestic supply. We also know that a great deal of additional supply starts to come back into the market around $80, and that we are going to get overshoots both on the upside and the downside. The fact that oil prices have broken the uptrend since the beginning of the year suggests we're in a much more volatile trading environment for oil now. But the more important point is that we're in a long-term range, and that that range could persist for more than a decade before we get new use cases starting to come through for oil, not least as it is u losing some of the potential use cases or the use cases that it has previously relied on, such as internal combustion engines. The other, I think, when we think about the excess of private capital that is out there, there is no country where that has been a bigger problem than China. Now, the Chinese market was closed in here today, but it was down again yesterday. Then we've also had some of the regional banks, and there are really only a very small number of them that are listed in Hong Kong, have had their trade suspended. This is another example of a largely private sector that is outside of the banking sector, or outside of the listed sector, that has the potential to be a source of problems. Regional banks in China have been borrowing hand over fist for years. They've had successive avenues for funding cut off from them over the course of the last few years, and now with the advent of defaults, then we're starting to see some of them go bust. So Jinju is the latest of those, and their auditor quit. Ernst & Young, their auditors quit last week. If you think about auditors and quitting their jobs, what they're essentially doing is kissing away at the potential for ever getting business from that company again. So they don't do it lightly. And what it suggests is that there are meaningful holes in the company's balance sheet. Then we've also had Baoshan, which was the first bank to be taken over in over a decade. The known unknowable in China is the natural default rate. Nobody knows the answer to that question. And that's a really meaningful question. It's something that we just are not going to get an answer for. Now, when we think about the budget balance in China, then they're running a budget deficit of about 2.9%. And I'm having difficulty bringing up the chart. So that deficit improved in 2018, but they've been running deficits since 2007. There's very little prospect that that deficit is going to contract again this year, and it is quite likely to expand. It is China's deficit spending, in tandem with the potential for the dollar to weaken, are two of the most important sources of liquidity for the global market. Then we have the size of the Fed's balance sheet. And that is due to stop contracting in September. So we have important sources of new liquidity coming into the market. China definitely needs stimulus, unless and they are likely to have much slower growth in future. I think something that has to be questioned, it is a potential eventuality that we can't simply ignore as global investors, and it is simply whether this is a trade war or a cold war. Because the ultimate strategy that ended the Cold War was to bankrupt the USSR. And I really wonder whether the geopolitical decision has been made in Washington to curtail China's global ambitions now, while it is still possible, or to allow China to persist for the next decade, at which point they will probably be too powerful to combat. Well, if you look at it from that perspective, then there is a clear argument for the trade war. There is a clear argument for migrating the manufacturing capacity away from China, from diversifying reliance on China as a manufacturing center and building up manufacturing centers in third-party countries like Vietnam or India, or indeed Taiwan or Korea or Malaysia, Indonesia, and indeed Mexico. It's also worth questioning whether the entire tariff question with Mexico is a bluff in order to try and get China back to the table. Again, what's I think most important is that these kinds of questions weren't even in the realm of the possible 12 months ago, or maybe more like 2 years ago, and now they are the kinds of questions that are open public discourse, and that represents an additional risk premium. So the market is currently responding to a massive source of potential new liquidity, and the removal of a headwind in terms of rising interest rates and reducing the size of the balance sheet. We are likely to get an additional leg on the upside. There is certainly the potential that that is going to create bubble valuations, most particularly in the privately held sector. There is also the scope that that is going to have a significant tail risk, considering the influence that non-bank lenders now have on the financial system and the holdings that public companies and pension funds have in the private sector. So we can already anticipate what the potential problems are going to be, but the most important point is that as long as these upside key reversals we've seen in here this week persist, that is likely to lead to an additional leg on the upside, which is going to be positive for asset prices generally, most particularly on Wall Street, because that has been the leader, but also for Europe, because investors will start to migrate away from a weakening dollar towards the relative currency stability of Europe. So Europe does have the potential now to start playing catch up, and the Euro Stoxx index has bounced from the region of its trend mean in here this week. And because of the reality of modern monetary theory, then this does look like a potential end to gold's long-term base formation. Well, if that's the case, sorry, I put up the wrong chart again. If that's the case, then perhaps we need to start thinking about the Dow Gold ratio, something that I've highlighted on multiple occasions over the course of the last decade. And there have been occasions during secular bull markets where we have had meaningful retracements. And I suspect that that is what we are about to get. There's going to be a meaningful retracement in terms of gold's outperformance relative to stock markets in response to the damage to currencies that the advent of modern monetary theory has. Because we are on the cusp of currency wars. So that, I think, is the other rather important point. Japan has already started to voice concerns about the potential for the yen to continue to strengthen. The Europeans don't particularly want a strong euro, but neither do they want it accelerating lower. We saw this week that the South African rand has pulled back to test the 15 area. The Australian dollar has been trending downwards now for years and is now testing the 70 cent level. Well, if the Australian dollar starts to strengthen up, that will probably put some brakes on the advance in its stock market. What we have seen too is that the continuous commodity index is right at the lower side of its range, but China represents a risk for this index. And I think that is a meaningful risk. If we had to think about where the risks to what is looking like an increasingly rosy scenario for asset prices, it is in the potential for China to become a really significant problem. India has the potential to become a major beneficiary as a result of that. Now, what's going on in India right now is that the RBI has cut interest rates three times in the last few months, and the rupee has been really reasonably steady against a background of lower interest rates. Well, the lower interest rates are aimed at supporting not the entire banking sector, but portions of it. We've had a default last year from IL&FS, and the banking sector continues to outperform. But we've also seen that Dewan Housing and Finance had a meaningful miss in terms of one of its debt payments this week. There is the real potential that it could go out of business. Then the other troubled bank is Yes Bank. That has already had a meaningful pullback. It's got a member of or it's got an employee of the central bank on the board. It's got a new CEO. They've written off a lot of their debts. Now the big question is whether they're going to get a recapitalization or whether we're going to see an exploration of additional downside, or indeed whether it's going to bounce from here. We're at a rather critical juncture. But what this is also highlighting is that India is taking proactive steps in order to mitigate some of the risks that are outstanding in terms of liquidity in the housing finance sector. The last thing India wants is a recession, and we're starting to see that activities are starting to push on now to support the financial sector. That's a positive, and it's probably a sector that's worth monitoring. India has got a massive demographic dividend that it can use to leverage growth in the economy. The trade war is a massive bonus for the potential for India to develop its own manufacturing sector. So there is certainly scope for India to take on a position of outperformance in here. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.